Hi, welcome to PMA Talks Tech, the podcast for fresh produce professionals that explores the people, companies, and technology solutions that are shaping the future of the produce industry. I'm your host, Bonnie Estes, Vice President of Technology for the Produce Marketing Association, and I've spent years in the ag tech sector. So I can attest it's hard to navigate this ever-changing world. So thanks for joining us and allowing us to serve as your guide to the new world of produce and technology. Today, I'm talking with two highly successful and well-respected venture capitalists in the ag and food tech sectors to discuss how their world looks today. What are investors saying and doing? What are the needs and solutions? And what is going on with startups? We will start with Sanjeev Krishman with S2G and follow with Rod LeClaire of AgFunder. You will get great insights into the world of tech and investment. Let's get started. Welcome, Sanjeev Krishnan. We now have Sanjeev Krishnan, the Chief Investment Officer and Managing Director of S2G. So happy to talk to you.
Great to be with you today, Bonnie. Excited to talk and share what we're doing and learn what you're doing as well right now.
Great. You know, I don't miss all the constant travel that we all were doing. You know, perhaps now with a different lens, maybe we were doing too much, but I do miss talking to people like you, and I miss going to your event and to really hear what's happening in innovation and new technology in the companies. And a conversation with you is always filled with all sorts of interesting new topics and new innovation. So since we can't get together in person, this is a good second way to do it.
Yeah, I think my second home is now Zoom. It was United Airlines,
and now it's
Zoom. So I'm getting acclimated. The food is just as bad or just as good, depending on the day.
Yeah, you know, I'm not between United and Zoom. Those are two hard things to choose between. So for our listeners that don't know about S2G, why don't you tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Yeah, so we are a food ag fund really anchored around the changing consumer and then the ripple effects of that across the U.S. food system. And we try to make investments that sort of nudge the food system in the U.S. towards sustainability and health. And so we invest across the value chain. So we do ag tech, food tech, supply chain tech, but also invest in sort of processors, brands, restaurant retail concepts. We have over 45 companies in our portfolio. We also invest multi-stage. So we do C-stage investing, venture investing, growth investing, and even open to doing buyouts as well. We have about 15 colleagues in Chicago and an outpost in San Francisco, and divide the world into sort of an investment team and a platform team. The platform team just really helps post-investment with things like talent, corporate development connections, marketing, a number of other sort of value-added services that really help manage sort of the three risks that we see when investing in food and ag innovation, which is really adoption risk, financing risk, and syndicate risk. We've been around since 2014 and are continue to be very active in the market even during this pandemic crisis.
Yeah, I think S2G, as opposed to some of the other investors, you guys really look across the whole supply chain and kind of hit all the areas that the Produce Marketing Association is really active in as well, because we really work all the way from seed to fork. And so it's always interesting to see how you look at things, because you're looking at the whole food system instead of just what's happening on the farm.
That's right. I mean, I think it's always been, I think, an area that of uniqueness for us that we've tried to take advantage of in terms of linking downstream companies with upstream companies and vice versa, or seeing trends in an upstream company that we can invest downstream in and vice versa. But this crisis, I think, has highlighted even the greater importance of supply chain linkages. We see very interesting bird's eye view, just given, you know, the fact that we have over 45 companies across that value chain. And could go into that if it's of interest.
Well, we're not only seeing supply chain linkages, we're seeing supply chain breakages.
That's right.
Been one of the really interesting things in this whole COVID world of how things are really connected together. So one thing that I wanted to ask you about, which was a funny thing for me, last week I had two firms who called me, one very, very large multinational investment firm and another one very small from across the other side of the world. And it was on the same day and they asked me the same question, which is, you know, what are we at PMA seeing around perishability in the supply chain? Like what's happening with being able to keep fresh food fresh longer? What are some of the technologies to reduce waste is how I think a lot of us were looking at it before. But I think now with COVID and where the supply chain is needing to stretch and people are looking at differently how they buy their fresh produce, you know, what's happening in that space. And I know that you have a number of investments in that area and it's an area that you've looked at. So I wonder if you could share with us your thoughts and about your companies and then what else you see might be coming to kind of fix some of these supply chain issues.
Yeah, no, it's a great point. And we've been very actually bullish on the perishable sector. And I know center stores had a little bit of a revival, but we still think perishables is a great place to invest and see growth. But obviously, in the produce sector specifically, you know, you're effectively, or any time that you're doing in the perishable space, you're effectively an inventory manager business. Is sort of the view we have. And so key to inventory management, I think, is, you know, data and digitizing some of that supply chain. So you know beyond either the shipper, packer, or at the DC, you know, how do you digitize your supply chain so you have a more holistic view of where issues occur, particularly even post-COVID, you know, if climate change impacts or other impacts that will come to impact the produce supply chain, you know, the sooner you know, the more you can plan. I think what we're seeing is, you know, both midstream, grocery, even I think food service when they come back, we're much more interested in digitizing the supply chain to manage shrink and to manage food waste. The second area that we looked a lot at and made a few bets in as well is post-harvest shelf life extension. So we've got Appeal and Hazel as investments in that area. And those are sort of material science platforms that I think are really compelling. And both companies are getting great traction from a distribution perspective and a business model perspective around sort of extending shelf life of fruit and veg. The third toolkit, if you will, that we invested in that's a little bit different perhaps is we also see the role of indoor and vertical as a potential way to manage inventory and shelf life extension. In a sense, we think that sector will probably have some tailwinds. They still have some work to do in terms of cost per pound, capital cost per square foot, and then ensuring the CapEx cycle such that they can service, you know, grocery and food service alike. But you know, we have a holistic approach to how we think about you know, shelf life extension management. I think there's another dynamic that we're very excited about and I want to make more investments is really around packaging solutions. Mm-hmm. That could be complement material science, but we think sort of, you know, there's going to be a lot more smart packaging that is both sustainable and can help with some of the shrink issues as well. So we're excited about exploring those four innovation areas.
That's great. I think there's so much going on in those areas. You know, a lot of trends were happening before COVID and now they've just been kind of sped up. But I think around indoor, there's so many people that want to buy local now, like that's become really important to them. So places where they can buy local, if there's, you know, an indoor vertical farm close to them, I'm doing that myself. I feel very fortunate that I can get really fresh local indoor greens. But so I think that's a great area around packaging. Another area that, you know, we've been thinking about is that right now there's this increased use in single use plastics because everybody wants to have a plastic barrier. So we're going back to using different plastic bags and we're putting apples in bags and, you know, everything in bags. And so I think as you guys start looking at, you know, there's going to be some increase in packaging, I think, coming out of COVID, but I'm sure you're looking at technologies that aren't plastic, that are other kinds of ways to put some sort of physical barrier and different kinds of packaging that doesn't come from fossil fuels.
Exactly. I think packaging has probably has a new dimension to it, which is beyond the sustainability argument. Is there a health argument, or at least a contact, you know, minimizing contact or transferability, you know, clean packaging that helps with, you know, mitigate, you know, some concerns that the consumer may have. So absolutely. So how do you blend both? And so we're just starting our journey in that area. But hopefully I'm going to make more investments in packaging this year and next year.
Great. So in the report that you recently came out with, which was an amazing report, Everybody Eats, and I suggest anyone get their hands on it that can, because it's just a great view of what's kind of happening during COVID. And then you look at the other areas that technology and innovation coming out of this. And one of the things that you say in the report is that pandemics cause innovation. So what kinds of new technologies are you seeing? And do you think these things will be adopted quickly?
Yeah, so the reason for the report is twofold. One, we were sort of trying to figure out what mental to approach it with. So a lot of it was 08, 09, or 9/11, or World War II. And so we were like, that doesn't really fit what's happening as much as pandemic economic history. And so it's a niche genre. Obviously, it's probably popular right now.
Yeah.
But one of the things you see consistently, from like the Justinian plague to the bubonic plague to the Spanish flu to like the major pandemics that have happened in human history, and it's an interesting pattern because it's all of them happening in different historical, you know, time periods in human history, is innovation comes out of those. After the bubonic plague, people think that it's one of the things that led to the Enlightenment. Sort of the advancement of medicine as we know it today really came out of the Spanish flu. In terms of, you know, just a greater respect for science and technology and medicine in particular. This pandemic, I think, will be similar in a sense that I think innovators and entrepreneurs have a tremendous opportunity to invent, and, you know, invention is necessity, things that will help with some of the core issues in our food system. I think one of the things that we see is, you know, the fragility of labor and logistics. And you've seen it obviously in the meatpacking sector, but I think you've also seen it even pre-COVID in the produce sector. And I think there's going to be, whether it's automation, robotics, digital tools, et cetera, I think that is going to, that's there's scope here for folks across the produce value chain to benefit from. I think the other thing that is going to be interesting is, you know, challenging the nature of globalization and food security, the notion of food security. We have some investments outside the U.S., and that is a key area of concern for a lot of governments and nation states across the globe in terms of, if you're importing a good amount of your produce or calories in general, how do you make investments to sort of at least have increased domestic self-sufficiency? And we think that's going to be a key thing, and innovation has a role in that. And it's not just indoor ag or others, but I think there's going to be a wide variety of ways that get to enhance food security and ensure sort of domestic self-sufficiency. I think so that's another sort of implication that comes out of this. The other one I think is really around channel digitalization, which I actually think has some really interesting potential for produce. About 2 or 3 years ago, we do these white papers internally, and then they never really see. This is the first one we've sort of made public. But we looked about 2 or 3 years ago. A very cliched word that venture capitalists like me use is disruption. Define disruption as changes in market share, and we looked at, you know, the last 25 years, what industries have had the greatest changes in market share and why. And the biggest R coefficient, the biggest correlation that we found is when the channel gets digitized. And so you see that in like very, quoted statistics around Netflix and video or music and Spotify and, you know, consumer batteries and Amazon. You know, Amazon went from 0 to number 3 in batteries once people started buying batteries online. And so this grocery movement is going to be super interesting in terms of the second order consequences and the third order consequences it has. Because, you know, is it we've gone from 5 to 7%, you know, online grocery to, you know, I think it's going to be, well, you know, 4 to 5x, if not higher than that. And a lot of folks that we spoke to in grocery, who always thought there was a little bit of a behavior change element to online grocery, and therefore it wouldn't really get as much adoption, have changed their minds, you know, in this crisis. And I think for produce companies, you know, how do you build maybe direct-to-consumer channels like you couldn't before? And what does that whole world look like? So I think that that channel digitization is going to have impacts, not just in how producers and shipper packers get things to market and the optionality they have, but also even in genetics. Like if you wanted to grow unique varietals, how do you, you know, differentiation's a lot, potentially quite compelling in an online digital world. So I'll pause there of three sort of impacts that I could see for the produce sector.
Yeah, those are really interesting. Thanks for sharing that. I think around digitization, you know, one of the things that I've been thinking about and looking at the industry is that a lot of the information just isn't shared all the way through the chain. And we're starting to see, you know, through things like the IBM Food Trust and companies, the retail companies, you know, reaching back and getting good traceability information coming towards them. But that retail information isn't going back to the grower for the grower to really have the same amount of information and for that chain to really be connected with each other. And one of the things I'm really hoping for coming out of COVID is that, you know, we start doing better forecasting and not just using the telephone and Excel spreadsheets, but actually have some good chains that are set up and some good demand and supply forecasting that in itself is going to help a lot around reduction of food waste and shrinkage.
Absolutely. There was some good data that I saw yesterday around the volatility of the S&P 500 versus produce. It was like produce was like significant. I can send it to you later, but it was significantly more volatile than the S&P 500. And the S&P 500 is the most volatile it's been in the last 10 years. And so it's just interesting to your point. Obviously, this is a moment in time that's unprecedented. But going forward, I think I always thought about that produce would be one of the first that have traceability, because there's always an issue of who pays in traceability. And I always thought food safety and food recalls were, you know, that was a great ROI for whoever pays and that whoever is made to pay or whoever pays. And now even things like surety of supply and surety of supply at a certain price point, you know, digitizing the whole chain is going to be, I think, valuable for whoever, whichever stakeholder you are, just so you don't have a net short or you understand your selling price or your buying price.
Yeah. And I think, you know, information is power. And I think as we get more data and the balance of power throughout the whole chain, it's just going to make things go a lot more smoothly. Well, I really want to thank you for spending time with me. And it's so great to hear your voice. I look forward to some time when we can actually stand somewhere and have a conversation, whenever that will be. But it's great to keep in touch. And I love the work that you guys are doing. So keep it up. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Thanks for your partnership in general. And would love to work more with PMA and you in terms of how we invest in innovation and how that gets deployed. So thank you again.
Great. All right. Bye.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Today, I'm sitting with Rob LeClaire. He's the founding partner of AgFunder, and it's so great to actually see you and talk to you. This is one of the things I miss the most about our new world, is not getting to catch up with people who I love talking to. So thanks for being here.
Thank you very much, Vani.
Yeah. So there will be some people, shocking as it seems, that don't know who AgFunder is, that are listening to this podcast, possibly in the produce industry. So why don't you talk a little bit about AgFunder and kind of when you got started and what you guys do?
Sure. So AgFunder, we consider ourselves sort of a digitally native venture capital platform. We started back in 2013. And at the time, there wasn't a lot of interest in technologies that related to food and agriculture. And I remember kind of going to, you know, a cocktail party and you'd chat with somebody and their eyes would roll back in their head and they would grab the nearest accountant that would walk by and say, get me out of here. And so, you know, what we realized is that this was such an important industry and that maybe it was sort of framed the wrong way, that there was an opportunity to get a lot bigger engagement and that there was so many technologies and some of the most cutting edge technologies in the planet could be brought to this industry. So if you love technology and were a futurist, this was a place to spend some time. So our theory on how we would get people engaged was through a lot of media and research. And so in 2013, we started AgFunder News. Today, we've published over about 2,500 articles on the space and tried to sort of generate a bit of a narrative around the most cutting edge tech, the leading investors in the space, the most talented entrepreneurs, and try to tell that story. And then in 2015, as we were sort of struggling to kind of come up with a real coherent thesis on investing in the space, we said, well, look, we really need to map out this market. And so this started a long journey of putting together research reports, investor reports that would really frame the sector. And so we started in 2015. I think there was $2.3 billion that was raised in 2014. And then the previous year, that was 3x over that year. And so it was a huge jump and people really paid attention. And then now fast forward to our last report we just published, where we calculated almost $20 billion in funding. So it's been an incredible journey to see this industry really mature and see capital coming in and solving problems for technologies that affect the bottom of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And if we can do that, I think that can have incredible impact. And then in 2017, we launched our first venture capital funds. And we've launched a series of, I will call it micro VC funds, to invest in the space. And today we're one of the most active investors. We invest in North America. Clearly we're based in Silicon Valley, but we also invest in India and Australia and Brazil and Europe and Asia. So we really are looking to find the companies that are going to transform the future of agriculture and really look at and meet those founders who are living in the future.
That's so great. The way you talked about really creating and kind of starting the narrative. You know, I've been working in ag biotech and in ag tech before it was called ag tech. And when you first started AgFunder News, you guys were the only ones that were writing about technology that was affecting agriculture. And I loved it. You know, I started throwing articles your way as well, because I wanted, you know, there was no place else to even send articles, but yeah.
And thank you for all your contributions as well.
Thank you. You guys did really start creating that narrative and have people start thinking about ag tech and what the different innovations coming from all over the world. So thank you for doing that.
Well, thank you.
So how are things looking in your world right now? Just kind of what are you talking about? What are you seeing? What are things like?
Yeah, I mean, certainly things are pretty crazy. We sent out a note to our portfolio companies, I think it was March 3rd, kind of trying to frame what we were seeing in the world and some of the risks. I think we're seeing what many people are seeing and some of the challenges around the operating in this environment. But, you know, I think when we speak to our portfolio companies, because almost all of our portfolios are supporting the food and agriculture industry, they are operating as essential services. And then the next question is, well, what does their activity look like? And our customers even care about what they're doing? And what we're finding is that, you know, when technology was coming in, it had the potential to make our food and agriculture system much more resilient. And there was some slow adoption. Sometimes it was hard to tell that story and why there's value there. And that is becoming much, much more evident now. So, you know, we're investors in a couple alternative protein companies. We're investors in a couple of automation companies. We're investors in some, digital marketplaces. And in all of those cases, you know, their customers are seeing far more demand for those products because they're really helping fill in problems that were always sort of there, but could be kind of papered over. For instance, you know, if a greenhouse goes down or people get sick on a farm, that could be, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars in lost value. And so automation is, you know, very important in an environment like that, where a tractor that's autonomous is not going to get sick. And the more people there are on a farm, for instance, the higher the risk there is. And so what we're seeing is these clients are starting to really speed up their adoption and their seriousness around innovation because of this.
Oh, that's fascinating. Yeah, I think a lot of the trends that were happening, were already happening before COVID. And then it did definitely speed up a lot of things that people were looking at. I talked to one startup that does a lot of forecasting and data analysis. And she was saying that, you know, she feels like Cinderella now, that, you know, everybody wants her at the ball.
Yeah.
We're thinking about it.
No kidding.
Yeah, it is really interesting to see. And that's one of the things that, you know, I wonder how things will look, you know, on the other side as we move through this unusual time. So what are you telling your startup companies, the ones you've invested in and other people, like how to get through this time and depending on where they are and raising money and ones that are going to come back to you and need more money, how are you dealing with that part of it?
Yeah, financing risk is probably the biggest challenge, right? So you have operational challenges, but most of the companies are kind of working through those. Then you have the commercial challenges. And if anything, as I mentioned, the companies are seeing more demand for their products and services. They may have more trouble getting them to the customer or working with the customer, but there is far more demand. The biggest risk, though, is in the venture capital market and evacuation of capital from that market. And this creates a lot of additional financing risk. You know, what we're telling our companies is basically, you know, be prepared for a long winter, because even if you have significant commercial success and you are maybe modeling a 2x or 3x growth over the next year and you're at 4 or 5x growth, that may not be sufficient to raise funding next year. And this is sort of what we saw in 2001 and 2008. Capital really evacuated the market. It was very difficult for founders. And so, you know, what we're saying is, look, and what we said back in March 3rd was, look, if you're going to make cuts, you want to cut early and you want to cut deep. At least you give an opportunity for the employees of those companies to find new jobs while there is still a market for jobs. And maybe that time has now passed. You know, we said, look, you really want to manage your burn rate. You try to extend yourself out 18, 24 months. If you can have 36 months of runway, great. Close bridge rounds. Don't feel that you're not in fundraising mode. I think if there's capital available, it's time to take it. And ultimately, think about survival rather than growth, right? So normally in a more frothy market, when the capital is available, we say, look, you know, put on the gas, grow as fast as you can, and capital will be there. Now we're saying, look, we don't know if the capital will be there. So what you want to do is build yourself to survive in the worst case scenario. Really focus on revenue right now, you know, to minimize your burn rate. Don't spend as much money and time on R&D, for instance.
Do you think this is going to result in more M&A and, you know, exits that are different than what people wanted? Do you think there's going to be companies that just aren't going to make it, but had great technology and someone will pick them up? Do you see that happening?
Yeah. I mean, you have these market instabilities and this creates opportunities for some buyers. And some of those buyers may be some of the better funded startups as well. But I guess it comes down to who might be the buyers in those markets. And if Bayer and Corteva or others are also hurting, they may be focusing more on their core as well. And that may...
Yeah, they're taking your advice as well. That, you know,
yes, exactly. you know, we've been speaking to some corporates and they were told to, you know, put a chill on all hiring, all investment, all M&A, and they're going to revisit this on a quarterly basis. So, you know, those types of things may inhibit those opportunities. And so, you know, we are actually doing a second close of our third fund because we wanted to be investing in this period. We know that valuations have come down. We know that there's tremendous opportunities emerging in this market. We are more bullish on this sector than ever. We see what the future looks like. And we're investors in venture capital, not for the next quarter or next 6 months, but for, you know, the next 10 years. And so, you know, we see that opportunity to be investing today. And, you know, others who have that long-term view may also be able to weather that as well. But sometimes when you're a publicly traded company and you really need to watch your bottom line, you may need to be more careful.
Yeah. Are you seeing many companies pivoting and trying to figure out how to change their business model so it may make more sense now, or is that happening?
Very little. I mean, just because, so, you know, alternative proteins was a theme for us in plant-based proteins. And, you know, the companies in our portfolio that are in market, you know, are seeing 3 to 4x growth. So their challenge is, how do we produce more when we're operationally constrained? So that would be one. Some go-to-market strategies are challenging. So we're investors in one company, and their plan was to launch in food service with some of the largest sort of food service providers. And they were just basically ready to sign those contracts. And now that's gone. Restaurants are gone. And that was sort of an avenue for them to launch. So now we're trying to get creative about how do you connect with consumers when you can't really get in, you know, get time with them and in front of them and get them that really intimate personal experience. So some of the go-to-market strategies have certainly changed. You know, as far as automation companies, geez, I mean, their clients are you know, beating down their doors, and some of that is because, you know, their clients have investors as well, you know, the people who lent them money who are worried that this operation is going to go out of business. And so for them to tell a story about how they're now speeding up automation to ensure continuity of their business and therefore continuity of, you know, those investor payments is really, really important. And digital marketplaces similarly, they, as you saw this sort of shift in the supply chain away from restaurant and more to grocery, digital marketplaces were really able to adapt quickly because they bring both buyers and sellers to the market, and those buyers and sellers don't need to have a pre-existing relationship. It can coordinate a market very quickly. So from that perspective, you know, we're just seeing lots of a lot of opportunity there.
Ah, that's fascinating. Yeah, I think the way that we get our food will be changed for a long time. And certainly, we're seeing a lot of people moving to buying online that, you know, that had never done that before. And that's likely to not go away. And so it'll be interesting to see what innovations come up around buying online differently. And then, you know, a number of the meal kit companies, some of those, I thought they were not going to make the quarter, but now I think with what's happening now, they've got a new vision on life, and it'll be interesting to see how people, you know, respond with that as well.
Yeah, a lot of these companies, they sort of needed to hit a critical mass to become profitable, and they sort of hit that in the last month and a half, and now they can really explore, and their cost of customer acquisition really dropped, and we'll see if people remain using these products and services, because that initial adoption can be really slow. You know, with Instacart, my wife and I would stubbornly just go to Costco every weekend, and now we're looking at it and say, geez, we're saving a lot of time. This is pretty nice not to have to go and spend 3 hours every Saturday going to Costco, buying stuff, and we can just get it dropped off. And so that's quite convenient.
That's interesting. We haven't made that leap yet. I mean, I make the list for 9 days of meals, and my husband dutifully goes and implements the list at the grocery store. So we're still doing that. But he went this morning, you know, and it took several hours. And if you're worried about infection, like, that's your highest risk place. You go in an indoor place with a bunch of people for 2 hours, you know. So yeah, I don't know.
My heart beat sort of is elevated. I've got my N95 mask on. so we've made a couple trips to the grocery store, but it's not a pleasant experience. That's for
no,
sure.
It's not at all. So one of the things you mentioned in the opening is that you do have investments all around the world. You guys have done a really good job of sourcing deal flow in companies, you know, throughout the world. So are you seeing big differences in different parts of the world and how people are responding and what's happening?
You know, I think the challenges are mostly the same. You know, I think the differences become when you're in either emerging markets or you're in developed markets, right? So in developed markets, there's operational challenges everywhere. But, you know, I think the biggest demand drivers, as I mentioned, were really in automation. In developing markets, it's been digital marketplaces because their supply chain is not very strong. It's not centralized. It's not efficient. And they were sort of doing things in a very ad hoc way, lots of kind of farmers markets before. So that has been a massive accelerant in those markets.
Well, I could talk to you for a lot more time, but this is about the time that we have allotted. So it's great to see you and talk to you, and hope to be able to have a cup of coffee at some point soon, you know.
Let's do a happy hour one Friday night on over Zoom or something.
That's it for this episode of PMA Talks Tech. Thanks for allowing us to serve as your guide to the new world of produce and technology. Be sure to check out all of our episodes along with other important content at PMA.com. Till then, stay safe, and we'll see you next time.